I went to sea at a very early age. I was brought up on a farm, and it was my dad's intention that I should be a farmer all my life, and I had no such intention at all. We lived on salt water, and we saw these big ships moving up and down, and I stood there in the barn window, and I looked out on them ships, and I could see them ships going down to these exotic islands, and with the hula girls and the coconuts and all that kind of stuff. And I just decided that I was going to go to sea, and I did. And I, as I told you the last time, now I made a mistake. I sailed on two square riggers, two Norwegian square riggers. One of them was the Pamelia out of Tweedestrand, and the second one was the Diana out of Kristiansand. I was on both ships at different times, but I was under the impression that I joined the Diana at Liverpool, but I didn't. When I come to think over where I was at, I joined her down at Adelaide, Australia. And that's another story. How did I come to get down there? We left Cork Island in ballast to go to the United States. I think we was going to Portobello and load mahogany logs for South Africa. And 1,100 miles out of Cape Clear, we sailed right into a big American steamer loaded with cotton for Liverpool. And of course, a three-masted bark, you know, it's has a lot of rigging on it, and the rigging came tumbling down on the main mast and also on the foremast and hanging over the side. And our rigging was pretty near old steel, and we had quite a time chopping that loose and getting rid of it. But the steamer laid by, and we got a wire on him and shackled that into the anchor chain. And he towed us into the mouth of Queenstown. Now, you'll have to remember that this was in 1914, just about the time that the World War I broke out. And them days, I know it's real hard for you people to believe, but we didn't have no electricity them days. We had no telephones, no radios, and certainly no automobiles. And another thing we didn't have was microwave ovens. There was just a lot of things we didn't have them days. And then we had an additional handicap that after the war broke out, the Germans was in possession of a good many islands out in the Pacific. And while he couldn't get the fleet out there after the Battle of Jutland, he did have a raider running around out there. And after we got out in the Pacific, why, we was a little worried about that. We was very worried about it. But anyway, we left Newport News, so rather Norfolk, with a cargo of coal. And even in them days, we was aware that the day of the sailing ship was done. There was not too many cargoes that you could put on a sailing ship and make a profit in it. A sailing ship either had to have a lot of ballast or else had to have a heavy cargo. And coal and wheat and kindred products was about the only thing we could haul. And if we couldn't get a cargo, we had to have ballast, because a big ship like that with a top-heavy hamper was tender, very tender. It could collapse very easily if you didn't have some ballast. And I know a couple of times when we run on the when we run light, and just in ballast, we had to be very careful with the sails that we didn't tip over, and many times sails was taken in to the point where we was not making very much speed, simply because we couldn't afford to put any more sails on her. She would lean over too much. Well, this time here, we went down there, and I think the skipper was a very good man. He had he had his wife with him. His name was Hansen. And he taught me how to navigate. And I was pretty handy. I could add and subtract already and do a little bit of dividing and things like that. I was pretty good with math, and he made use of that. On the Diana, we had a crew of 32 men. We had 10 men on each watch. You stood watch and watch, 4 hours on, 4 hours off. And then the afternoon watch from 4 to 8 was split in two-hour watches, which we called the first dog watch and the second dog watch. And that was done there so that you wouldn't have the mid-watch 2 days in succession. You changed off. You had a different set of watches. But the fact is that we mostly all worked during the daytime, and it just so happened that I was real good with a sail needle and a palm, so the first thing he found that out was he made me the sailmaker's helper. We had a sailmaker, a carpenter, a bosun, and a steward. He was, you might call them petty officers or something like that. These still do watches. And anybody on board that ship that didn't stand a watch was what they called an idler. But other than that, on average days when the weather was nice, you had 10 men on each watch, and that was enough to furl ordinary sails if we had to furl them. And, of course, if the weather was bad, like going around the horn or something like that, why, when they called old hands, why, that meant just that. That meant the old hands, including the ship's cook and everybody that could climb the rigging. But this time here, we towed through the canal. We breezed right across the Pacific in the southeast trades, just hardly taxi, rope, everything was going along, and the ones that was not at the wheel was on the lookout, and the mate, he had a little whistle hung around his neck, and the rest of them was sleeping in coils of ropes laying around there, and getting the rest, because we all worked in the daytime. The all sailing vessel skippers, he believed in keeping the crew busy, then they didn't have no time to take up devilments, you know. And so we was busy. He had a little ditty used to kind of sing out through the sailing fleet that on 6 days you shall labor and do all that you are able, and on the 7th day you shall holly stone the deck and scrape the cable. So we was busy, but it was a good ship. It was a happy ship. And, of course, sailors are not never really happy. They always complaining about something. They complain about the salt meat and the hard tack. But it was not very often we had to eat too much hard tack, because we had a good cook and we had a good galley, and he baked bread. And he would bake bread until someday he would find beavers in the flour, you know, and for a couple of days he'd just let it go, you know, bake them in too, I guess. And then one day somebody would shake a piece of bread and a beaver would fall out, and that was the end of the bread, so we went on hardtack and we got some more flour someplace. But anyway, we breezed in through the, uh, And I think we've raced into the Leeward Islands and up to the Caribbean, got into the canal, and a tug came out and got us. And he towed us through the canal. And I knew that the skipper intended to go. The call was for Jakarta. And we figured that he would probably figure on going down to Australia and get a load of wheat and take that up to Europe someplace. You could always get a cargo of wheat down there. Well, we came through the canal, and like I say, we breezed right across, and he was always very careful that we wouldn't get scurvy. Cruise on big ships, them days, Wendy was at sea for long periods of time, and some of these, especially the whalers that was out for 2 or 3 years, the crew got scurvy because he didn't have no vegetables and didn't have any potatoes or anything like that, so teeth got loose and the teeth fall out and the gums got all loose. So the English, many years ago, they found out that he fed them a half a cup of lime juice every day. Why, that would stop the scurvy. And that's why to this day we call an English sailor a lime juicer. But it was all right. It worked, and he made sure that we got our lemon juice or orange juice or whatever it was. And another thing we didn't have them days that you have now so much is canned goods. Canned goods, the only canned goods I ever saw them days was canned butter. We had no canned goods. And I didn't see no canned goods until I got in the Navy sometime in 1918. But I guess they started canning before that, but we didn't have any. So what we had was salt meat. We had barrels of salt meat. And salt, good salt beef, you know, the cook would take out a couple of big chunks and boil it and get some of the salt out of it. And then he would also put something else in there and take the salt out. I don't know what it was, but a powder he had, and get as much salt out as he could and then boil a big chunk of beef. And that's what we had. We had no vegetables. We had beef and bread, hardtack. And the hardtack was good and nourishing, but it was awful hard on your teeth. And I had good teeth them days. But anyway, we didn't live bad at all. We got along good. I was the sailmaker's helper. And this particular Captain Hansen, he had his wife with him, and she was a Russian. And of course, very few of us could speak any Russian, and she couldn't speak any English, and she couldn't speak any Danish or any Norwegian or anything like that. So the poor lady was really hard up for somebody to talk to, so she had a cat. Well, the ship was a whaleback. And that meant that she had a curved space in the back there that was perfectly dark, and we used that for a sail locker. Now, you had marks on the sails. If you got the kringle, the sheet kringle, either one of the sheet kringles, you could go inside where the canvas started, and there would be letters in there, like LT or up. Up T or whatever it was, at top gallant, and that would be the initials on there, and I could feel for them initials, and then I would know what sail it was. I didn't have to drag all the sails out. And we was always patching sails. At first, the sailmaker would only let me sew on bolt ropes and kringles, but after a while, he figured I was better than he was about the 8 stitches to the inch, and he let me sew canvas too. And there I sat all day long on that bench with a palm sewing canvas, and your fingers got so sore you couldn't hardly stand them. But after a while, you got calluses on them, and then you could go right along. And that, you know, another thing we didn't have them days was kitty litter. I don't think it was known them days, but the cat was, I could see that cat was in distress, you know, and whenever somebody left that cell lock a door open, that cat would sneak in that dark space in there. And I would go in there, try to get a sail out there, and be feeling for them ladders in that cell, and I would slap my hands into a pile of that stuff there, and all you had to wash with was salt water and salt water soap, and it seemed to me like I could never get that smell off my hand. So, I think the cat knew I was mad at it, because it every time it went by me, it just strutted, you know. Well, the way we stood on the make watch one night, I was on the lookout. You went to the lookout, and then from there you went to the wheel. Well, I first been relieved of the lookout, and I was on my way back to the wheel, and here comes this cat up the deck there, and I think that cat knew that I was mad at it, and I couldn't do anything about it, because his tail was sticking right straight off with a little curl on the end. And I got so mad at that cat that I grabbed the tail and fresh over the side he went. I no sooner let go of that tail than I regretted it, because she was such a nice lady. And I knew how much she tore to that cat. But I also knew how little I tore off it. And over the side the cat went. I tell you, I didn't feel good at the wheel, and I didn't even feel good after I was relieved and went back there. My conscience hurt me that bad. So, in the morning, when he couldn't find the cat, we searched that ship there from the chain lockers to the lazarette. There was no place we didn't search, even down the chain locker, but no cat. And I never opened my mouth. I didn't say a thing. I knew that he would have tossed me over the side if I had even confessed that I was the one that threw the cat over. Well, we stopped at a little island on the northern end of Luzon after we got over to the Philippines. And the skipper went to shore, and he came out there with a boatload of sweet potatoes and Irish potatoes and four or five bunches of bananas and all kinds of fruit, breadfruit, mangoes, anything you could think of he brought out there. And we hadn't even furled the sails. We were just laying there at a short chain. And as soon as he came on board there, we hoisted in the boat and we took off again. And we started down there through the South China Sea, was headed for Indonesia to get that coal to Jakarta. I never could figure out why a hot place like Jakarta would need any coal, but it did. So we were steaming on down there, and I take sick about a week out. Another man of the crew, he was the Alaska, Indian. He was, what did you call them, them people that come there from Indonesia? Alaska, he called them. And he took sick. And after a while, I throwed up, and then I throwed up blood. And I went to bed, and I stayed there, and after a while, after about a week or 10 days, I passed out. I didn't know where I was at, and I thought I was going to die, and so did he. I couldn't eat. So, another week, while the skipper got scared, instead of going right down to Jakarta there, he put into Singapore. And when I came to, I was laying in the hospital. Now that's one thing you have all over the world, for merchant sailors. You have free hospitalization in all major ports and even the minor ports. You go into the public health service and you are taken care of. And I can remember that, how hot it was in that hospital. Singapore is only about, well, if it isn't right on the equator, it can't be more than 2 degrees away from it either way. I think it's 2 degrees north of the equator. There was no doors in that hospital, but he had hangings, you know, drapes hanging down there, and I could see them drapes waving in the breeze. And that was the first thing I noticed when I came to. But I was sick. I was so sick that I was hoping that I would die. Couldn't hold anything in my stomach, and I asked the doctors what was the matter with her. He said, well, he said, something you ate up there, something that the three of you ate, he burned one of them out at sea. And I said, something you ate had a bug or something that contaminated your insides. He said, your alimentary tract, he said, was all swollen. And no food could pass down there except liquid. But anyway, after 2 or 3 weeks, I began to get better. And I finally got to the point where I could get up and wander around the hospital. And I could, I got interested enough in my own welfare to find out where my gear was at. Because, them days, you know, a sailor carried all his gear with him. For instance, you always had a pair of good leather sea boots. And you had a tick. Because when you came aboard a ship, all you got was a bunk with a wooden bottom in it. So if you had that tick, you could load that up with hay or straw or whatever you could get to put in there, and then you had a reasonable good bunk to sleep in. Well, I done a little better than that because, long time before that, one time up in Scotland, I bought a sleeping bag. And that was the handiest thing I ever had. The outside was weatherproof, waterproof, and it had a little tent that came up over your head with a couple of pegs. You could pop that out, and it was just a real good thing. And then when in my spare time, I sewed, out of unbleached muslin, I sewed 2 big sacks that I could pull up on myself, and then I could go to bed with my boots on, and not get the inside was kind of a fur pile or something like that, and I could go to bed with my boots on, and I could be up there in just no time. And when the weather was hot, why, I just slept on top of it. And you have to have oilskins, you have to have maybe a couple of pairs of shoes, and you have to have a decent suit of clothes to go ashore in. So by the time you got all that stuff together, you had a pretty good big sea bag full of stuff. And if you didn't have that, you was just out of luck, because on these ships there, yeah, they had a slop chest. But all they had in that slop chest was mostly tobacco and cigarettes. I didn't smoke cigarettes, but I did smoke a pipe. And little things like razors and safety razors and blades and shaving cream and things of that nature. So, and what you did, you buy that there and you take it out of your pay. Well, I was getting better in that hospital, and I was beginning to think that I better begin to get out of there, because hospitals was never one of my favorite places to put in any time. But the doctors wouldn't let me go. So, he let me wander around town. There was only 2 blocks down to the to the harbor, and I used to go down there and wander around and look at the ships that was laying alongside and the ship that was laying out in the stream at anchor, I had a good life there, but I was still sick, and I was still so weak that I could hardly move. And I was beginning to wonder if I was ever going to amount to anything again. So, I'm down there one day, and I'm sitting on the string piece, and I was sitting there admiring a little schooner that was laying down there, a little two-masted schooner. And it reminded me so much of that schooner I sailed with that I couldn't get along with the skipper's wife, that I just sat there and looked at it. It was a nice little ship. I saw some men down there working on the deck, and I was sitting there admiring her and not thinking about anything. But I was thinking about going up and turning into the shipping master, because for most of my seagoing career, I belonged to the International Seafarers Union. Well, it was not because I had any particular good reason to be a good union man or anything like that, but on these big seaports, it was about the only way that you could get a job, because the shipmaster, when he come into port, he would go up to the hiring hall, and he would tell the shipping master what he wanted. He wanted so many ABs and steamship, wanted so many firemen, oilers, engineers, or whatever. And that way, it brought the two parties together, and you could ship out if you wanted to. If you didn't want to, why? But you didn't get anything else out of it. But the cost for belonging to it was trifling, and it was well worth it. I was sitting there looking at that ship there, and I wasn't even thinking about going to sea, or I didn't think I was ready to, because I was still sick, I was still weak. And I'd never been so weak in my life that I couldn't eat good. So up comes, out of the cuddy, somebody sticks his head out there. And when he stuck his head out of the cuddy, he was almost right opposite me. And he said, how do you like her? Oh, I say, I like her very much. I think it's a nice ship. I said, you ever sail on one of them before? Oh, yes, I said, I'm a Dane, and I used to sail on them small ship up through the North Sea and the Kattegat and the Skagerrak and the English Channel, and yeah, I sailed all through it. Well, he said, would you like to go with me? And I said, yeah, I would like to, but I say I'm not hardly in any shape to. I said, I'm sick. I've been sick for a month now, maybe 2 months. I don't know. I lost track of the time. But I say, I was just about to go up to the shipping master and put my name in for a job someplace. Well, he said, I need somebody like you. He said, can you do any navigation? Yeah, I say, I'm pretty good at that, too. So I guess he thought I was bragging. So I went up to the hospital, and I talked the doctor into signing him a release. And he also gave him a sea bag, and in the top of my sea bag was my money. I had, he had left there, he had 80 Hong Kong dollars in there. Out there we had three different kind of money values. We had Australian dollars, Hong Kong dollars, and Singapore dollars. And it was all a different value. It was not all the same thing. But anyway, that made me sort of independent. I had a little money. Well, we left. we left that night, and he told me, he said, I'm a copra schooner. He say, I'm what you call a trading vessel. He says, I carry all kinds of stuff to these people up in these islands need. Hardware, and garments, clothes, linen, bolts of cloth, and everything like saw, axes, hammer. They say, no junk. He say, oh, I carry all good stuff. And he say, if you want to trade for materials that I have, he say, why, we do that. And if you don't want to trade with me, why, he say, I paid him in money. But he say, when I get the ship full of copra, he say, we go back down to Parramatta and we unload. And then we take on supplies and then we go back out again. He say, I try to get my supplies at Sydney as near as I can. That's my home port. So, she was a nice little ship. She had a raised cuddy in the back that was raised up off of the main deck about 5 feet. And down in the cabin, there was a table folded to the floor. And I didn't know it at the time, but by taking that table by the legs and throwing it forward, you open the hatch down to the lazarette. And that's where he kept his supplies, his trading goods, and also his liquor. He was, I found out later, he was a heavy drinker. And I found out why, too, because one time, I think it was in Coupon, I tried to get into a saloon, but I was too young. The bartender chased me out every time I almost got in there. I wanted the schooner of beer, but he wouldn't let me in. But this fellow here told me, he said, that this skipper of mine, he used to be captain of a big P&O liner. And somehow or another come down through the Malacca Straits. It's kind of narrow there. He put on the rocks, and he had several passengers on board, so he fired him. But he didn't take his ticket. So, of course, that was a terrible disgrace. So he went down to Sydney, and how he got that schooner, I don't know. But I think he told me he bought it in Sydney. She was a nice little ship. She was exactly 100 foot on the waterline. She had a clipper bow, and she had a square stern, and in heavy weather, she was kind of wet. But she was a nice, down in the cabin, there were two bunks, one over here on the right-hand side, on the starboard side. That was his bunk. And they were so constructed, you had panels there you could slide shut. So when you got in your bunk, and you wanted privacy and didn't need any air, why, you could pull them panels shut, and you was in there. Nobody could bother you. Well, then on the port side was the same kind of a bunk. And he told me, he said, that's mine. That was mine. So I put my sleeping bag in there. And the weather down there was hot. And I don't think that in all the time, I was on there for 11 months, I don't think I slept in that bunk more than a half a dozen times. Only when it was real cold and we were tied up to the dock, then I would go down below and sleep, and then I knew we were safe. But if we was out at sea or anything, I slept on the hatch covers. Sometimes I slept on top of the cuddy. And so we got along real good. It was his habit to get up in the morning and take the psychs. Now, you have to remember, too, that these days, a coast like Australia, even if you was going along the coast and you always had to keep well out, maybe 20 miles off of the beach, you could see the land, yeah, but there was no marks on there. 1 mile of that land looked just the same as the next mile. So while you knew you was out in deep water, you couldn't fix your position. So even when we were running along the coast, while we navigated, we took sights. And we only had one sexton, so it became the habit that in the morning he would come up just at daybreak or a little bit before daybreak. Because another thing down in them tropics, there the twilight only lasts about 5 minutes. Either it's all of a sudden it's dark night and hey, daylight. So, in order to get a sight, you gotta have a horizon, and it's still gotta be dark enough so you can see your stars up there. Right? If you can't see the stars and don't have a horizon, you can't take a sight. And you don't have much time to do it there. But he came up every morning, well before daybreak, and I was most always awake at that time too, and a lot of times he would take the sight with his sextant and then go in and put it away, and he would mark down what he had taken and give it to me and let me figure it out. And sometimes he would figure it out. And we went around to these islands. We went up to the Marshalls, to the Ellis Islands, to the Gilberts, to the Solomons. And let me tell you right now, I don't know whether anybody in here is still being down to Solomons, of a more miserable place on the face of this earth, I don't know. He got bigger mosquitoes there than anything you ever saw. And you can be anchored in a bay there, almost out of sight of land, and you'll come out and get there. Also, the heat in them Solomons there is of a very, very depressing nature. It just saturates you. Your clothes are soaking wet. All I wore down there was a pair of short shorts and no shirt or anything, and I was burnt just about as black as the natives we had out there. Now to get back to the crew, we had five Tanakis on board there. And he came from one of the French islands. And he was in charge of a headman. The headman was probably a much better sailor than both the skipper and I was. I mean, as far as being a sailor is concerned. He sailed that ship. And many, many times when I took a sight, for instance, at noon, I would take the sun for a latitude. And many times I would take a sight and mark it down on the plotting sheet and then transfer it to the chart. And I would get the head man down and say, where are we? And he would put his finger almost on the point. He was a good sailor. Another thing he did, we had a flying jib and two more jibs that came up from the bowsprit up to the mast. And we had a flying jib, what down in these yachts there, you'll probably call a spinnaker. But it was a flying jib, and it had no boom on it. But it was a great big sail. And then we had two topsails. And every night, right before dark, them kites come in. Topsails came down with furled, and the big jib came in. And very rarely we have to do anything in the night, even the breeze freshened up, because we had the kites in. And that was the only thing that would really be bad in the event of a heavy weather. Well, we going around to these islands, they, you know, when you get acquainted with them, pick up a wheelbarrow load of copra. You people probably know what copra is, but copra is the dried meat of the coconut. And he just split the coconuts and threw them out in a couple of days, and that hot sun, why the meat peels away from the shell, and he put that together, and we would get a whole load of that and take it down to Parramatta. I don't know what, I think he made cocoa butter and oleo margarine and made face cream out of it. I went ashore there and sometimes on some of these French islands, he had hired an agricultural expert to come in there and put the coconut grove on a commercial basis. And I talked to some of them Frenchmen. I couldn't talk much French, and he couldn't talk much English, but we got along pretty good. And he told me that his chief complaint was to get somebody to work. Who wants to work there? You want to eat, you go out and pick banana or pick a breadfruit or mango. You're hanging all over the place. Who wants to work? You don't have to work. Throw your shoe up in a tree and that will come something to eat. So he, and on other islands, like Enivitok, and Tarawa and Apamama and a couple of them islands up there, why the headman was running the coconut business. And I had a proposition down there. The headman wanted me to quit and come in there, and he had a real beautiful daughter. He thought she was beautiful, and I could have her if I would just stay there and supervise the production of coconuts. Well, we didn't really get out into the Polynesian islands, where people are a little better looking than what you were up in the Gilberts and the Ellis, and because them people was. Them people was fussy haired, and he had that protruding jaw, you know. And I never really believed in that book that what's his name wrote about the origin of species there, about we all descended from monkeys. But after I saw some of them. Some of them natives in Australia and some of them guys in them Melanesian islands, I kind of thought maybe there might be something to that. He kind of looked that way. So, but I, but anyway, I declined the proposition. I told him I was too young to get married, and I really didn't have no ambition to settle down and grow coconuts. And he say, you don't have to grow coconuts. He say, all you got to do is just lay around in a hammock like I do. And he was so fat, awful fat. Well, we passed up them kind of business. But we really got around down there, and we had real nice trip there, and I figured, well, it looked like I'm all set for life here. Now I can keep on doing that until I can find myself a nice island someplace. I'll just settle down on that. But then I got to thinking about my family back home. I said, no, I don't want to settle down here. I want to eventually go home. But we visited, I don't know how many islands down there, and we had bad weather sometimes. We was in a couple of typhoons. And all the time we had to keep looking out for this raider down there. We had the, we heard about the Germans had rigged up a steamer with plywood, and he could make her into a one stacker or two stacker, and make her look like a freighter and make her look like most anything. We never saw her, thank goodness. So we got along real good, and well, I don't know, the we come to a part here now that really was sad. We came down from the Ellis Islands and stopped in a Cupang, and we took on board a lot of supplies there, and some of the supplies I saw going down in the hole there was caddy shark and Bushmills Irish cream and Keats's Scotch cream and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, we put it all on board because you could get it cheaper there than you could any place else. So we went, after we left Cupang, which is on the island of Timor, we went down and went through the tourist streets. Then he told me, he says, I want to go to Norfolk. So, okay, we laid the course for Norfolk, and in a week's time we made Norfolk. And he had something for somebody at Norfolk. We didn't take on any cargo at Norfolk, but we went a few miles south of Norfolk to another little island there, Phillip, and we took on some cargo there, and he had some stuff for somebody on Phillip. So he told me, he said, "No, he said I want to go home. We're just about full." And he says, "I want to stop in at Brisbane before we go down." I said, "All right." So he laid a course from Phillip to Brisbane, and we started out. And we had beautiful weather. We was on the starboard tack and cruising right along. And I think we was getting right close to Lord Howe Island there when he failed to come up one morning. And he always came up and took the sight in the morning. Now, I guess he was satisfied with that. That would do his whole day. But he didn't come up this morning. And I was sleeping up out on the hatch covers, and I began to get worried. So we only got about 5 minutes to take the sights there. It's either dark or daylight, just like that. So I don't know, something didn't feel right. He still didn't come up. Well, it got past the time when he could take a sight. So I goes down in the cabin, and his arm was hanging out of the bunk. And I took a hold of his hand, and it was ice cold. And then it dawned on me, he's dead. I'm telling you, you could have knocked me over with a proverbial fender. It just seemed like he cut everything out from underneath you there, because... Well, he was a skipper, he owned a ship, and he was our father, so to speak, and I was just a big kid. I thought I was much bigger than what I really was. I found out then that I wasn't very big. So I went up and I got the head man. and he was at the wheel, but I called the cook. He was getting ready to stir up the stove and make breakfast. I called him, and he took the wheel, and he come down, and he put his hand on his forehead and said, yeah, he's dead. So we took him out and took his mattress out and laid it on the deck in front of the table there, and we tried to give him artificial respiration, but we couldn't do anything. He was gone. So I said to the head man, I said, you know, I said, he told me he wanted to go to Brisbane. I don't know what he wanted to go to Brisbane for, but I says, we're not going to go to Brisbane because I don't know anybody at Brisbane. And I say, we'll change course and we'll go right to Sydney. Yeah, the man said, but he said, it'll take 3 days, maybe four if the wind fails. It'll take, and what we're going to do? It was January and it was hotter than Billy the doggone. I say, I don't know. But anyway, he went up on deck and he piled the jibs back onto the top sails, and boy, we scooted along. And I sat down there and talked, and I knew if we come into Sydney and tell the authorities in there that the skipper died out at sea and we buried him at sea, there'll be no end to the investigation. We'll be suspected of this, that, and the other. And I say, I feel guilty enough already that I don't want to be put in jail for something like that. And I talked to the head man about it, and the head man told me, he said, I don't know, he said, he didn't speak very good English. In fact, he didn't speak very good of anything, but he grunted, and I could understand him, and he told me, he said, I was on board a British bark one time, and he said, running from Australia to England, he had his wife on board, and she had a baby. He gave birth to a baby on the way. Well, anyway, I don't know whether the baby was stillborn or whether he didn't know neither. Maybe 2 or 3 days old. Just a small baby. But he said his wife insisted on taking the body up to England to bury it in the family plot. And the weather was hot there too, and he was headed for the Horn. Probably had 100 days coming before we got up to England. But the skipper finally gave in. I guess he figured, like a good many officers, arguing with a woman, there's just no future in that at all. So the carpenter made a little coffin, and he put the baby in the coffin, and he hoisted it up to the top gallant cross trees and tied it in on the little platform right over the lubber's hold. And that's the way that baby got back to England. So he told me. And I sit there and I got to thinking, well, I say, you know, reading the English history, I remember that Lord Admiral Nelson, who was killed aboard the Victory at the Battle of Cape St. Vincent, better known as the Battle of Trafalgar, but he was killed, and he brought his body back to England in a cask of brandy. Yeah, but he said, we ain't got that much brandy. Well, I said, we got plenty there now. I say, I tell you what, we're going to bring that body into Sydney. Now, up forward of the foremast, we had a barrel that we saved rainwater in. A lot of times it rained profusely up there. And that water we saved in there, it was a little black. You see, it had a little salt in it and all that, but it was plenty good enough for washing and cooking potatoes and things like that. So we went up there and we pulled the plug on that valve. And then we tipped the table forward and went down the last of that. And when all the water went out after, we took all the booze. We even found a can of rum. I don't know what it, but it was alcohol of some sort. And we dumped in Teach's Highland Cream, Caddyshark, Bushmills Cream, everything into that barrel. And then we took him up. We took him up and sat him down in his pajamas right in the keg. And we had the alcohol come up here just about to his belt. But that's all the alcohol. We emptied everything in there and threw the bottles over the side. And then we went down and got a 50-pound sack of salt and dumped that in too, and then filled it up with salt water. But then when we got up to hay, he started to float up. Well, naturally we got so much liquid in there that he floated up. So I told the head man, I said, go back on the boat and get the boat anchor. We had a little patent anchor back there. And it weighed probably about 40 pounds, and we put that in his lap. And that he sat right down to the bottom, and he sat down there just like that, like he was playing, with a fluid right over the top of his head. Well, we had a good wind. On the third morning, I took sight after sight, and I laid the course out, and on the third morning, right before daybreak, we came in through the Sydney Heads and anchored in front of the quarantine station and hoisted up the yellow flag. And as soon as it got daylight, the doctor came out. Now, we didn't have to go in quarantine because we came from an Australian island. Philip was the last place you was in. But that was a good way to get the doctor out there. And I wanted to get word into Sydney, into the harbor master and the chief constable and whoever was interested. So the doctor came out, and he had a harbor pilot with him. And I told him what had happened because I had everything marked down in the log just exactly like it happened. The latitude, the longitude, the time. And I even had the head man sign his name. His name was Sam Odo, but he couldn't write. So I put down Sam Odo. And he just held his thing on the pen while I signed his name. He couldn't write. He couldn't read neither. So the doctor went up and looked at it, took the lid off of the barrel and looked at it, and he said, he looks like he's in good shape.